Good morning, Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry.
We made it.
Yeah, such a deal. Can't believe it. Miracles do happen.
They do. Hey, so boy, I have to tell you, what a contrast. You know, I really got hooked on us being able to do these things together with a microphone, and now we got to do this again.
I know, we're out of practice, needless to say.
Needless to say, but we'll do the best we can. But
no doubt,
it's going to help that I have a brand new Bro Show t-shirt with the Clark Street Ale House event on it. And wow. That's all I can say. Wow.
Well, yeah, I'm sporting my Clark Street shirt, so I feel I'm in good uniform here.
Yeah.
As usual, don't ask me what's below the shirt, because there's not much there, except for equipment. Jeez.
Yeah, hardware, right. Yeah, I know the feeling. Well, join the club.
Oh, boy.
Well, anyways.
I tell you, everybody misses you up here.
Uh-oh.
Where is my brother? You're so popular.
In your building,
you
mean?
What's that?
At the building or at the ale house?
Everywhere.
Ooh, that's something.
Where's that guy that used to sit in a chair in front? How did your brother do? Is he back home yet? That's all people want to talk about up here.
Well, you could get a complex from that.
Yeah, I mean, now I'm getting up in the morning and say, where's my brother?
Oh, well, that's so sad. Oh, well. We'll somehow persevere.
Yeah,
I have to say something about the shirt, though. You know, I've tried to kill this shirt campaign 3 times now. And what happens is people keep emailing me or, you know, Facebooking me or whatever that's called, and saying, Jerry, I got to have one of those T-shirts. And so I had to twice now I've reopened the campaign. So it's good for another week. If people want one of these T-shirts, and boy, people want them evidently, go get them. We've got plenty left, and it's not going to close for another week. So,
wow, that's great.
Well, got to do what we got to do. We had no idea it would be so popular.
That's for sure. So
we're doing something.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, here we are here it feels like fall, and when fall takes place, football seems to be high on the list of sports when it comes to coverage, etc.
Yep.
So I thought we'd take a little plunge into football. Maybe not a plunge. I guess better would be let's tip our toe. Let's not get too overwhelmed here. And so we picked a variety of topics on football. I have kind of a passing interest in football myself, and that's what kind of piqued my interest as we hit the first week of college football. And, you know, my allegiance when it comes to watching football or listening or keeping track of is Northwestern University, where I went to graduate school, and they eked out a victory this last week. But what I like about Northwestern is they're an underdog. So, you know, back in the days, 25 years ago, you expected them to lose. And when they won, it was like a earth-shattering event. I remember days when they would win a game and they'd take the goalpost down. That's how significant it was. So I am attracted to this David Goliath thing.
Yep, who isn't?
Yeah, and so the Cinderella story is what I'm looking for. And I was hoping a couple of them would evolve last week. And well, the other thing that happened is Northwestern last year lost to a team, Western Michigan, which went on a 12-0 streak. And all of a sudden, one of the things that happens when you lose to a team that's worse than you, you start rooting for that team to get credibility so it makes you look better.
Right.
And
sure enough,
that's what I did. And I thought, well, last week I'd pique an interest, pique a little look at, see what Western Michigan was up to. And that led me to the fact they were playing University of Southern California, which is ranked 4.
And big team.
And they're playing in Southern California. And here's another thing that I happened to notice. And, you know, weather seems to be in the news. And sure enough, last week, California weather was in the news
That's
because
right.
of heat.
Big time.
Well, this game was played under 99 degrees weather. I mean, these
oh
guys were
God.
Sweating their whatever's off.
Yeah.
As they play. So you got a small team playing a big team. And then I noticed that in the going into the fourth quarter, the game was tied. And then all of a sudden, Southern Cal just took over and won 49-21. But it made me think, you know what? What happened? What are the statistics underneath it? What do they show? And one of the things they showed that was pretty obvious, and this is a tactic that Northwestern has used, and that is ball control. If you can keep your defense off the field, you're more likely to be fresh, because if you got ball control, you can run. You have more. Obviously, you have control of the game. What plays you're going to use? You're going to pass. You're going to run, etc.
And
Western Michigan had about a sizable, advantage in that regard. But then I thought, you know what makes the difference? Depth and substitutions. Mm. So I thought, well, substitutions. You know, Western Michigan doesn't have the. Perhaps not only don't they might substitute, but their second line is not going to be as good. And then I thought, well, you know, substitutions are becoming more popular in other areas other than quarterback. Well, in running back is the logical one.
Yeah, that's the one they always substitute.
Offense.
Yeah. Right.
But doggone linemen. And last year, I remember hearing something about it. So I thought, well, I'll have something to talk about because all I have to do is Google it. And get information on substitutions.
Right.
And I find nothing. Zero. Zilp. Zip. You know, there's just nothing out there.
Wow.
What's going on? What's going on with statistics in football? The statistics are there, but the information that deals with strategy that you would think people would be doing studies on, it's not happening. There's nobody doing it. So I was getting very, very frustrated. And so I actually had it confirmed in an article that I read that came out in August of this year that says numbers game, analytics spreading through college football. In other words, it's finally arriving.
Hold on. Let me get this straight. So, you, of course, you're a big baseball fan and you're a big baseball statistics guy. You're part of Sabre and all that good stuff. So what you're telling me is that football's now just starting to use some of the data they've been acquiring all these years to do analytics and strategy, whereas baseball's been doing it for how long?
Well, baseball actually is kind of interesting because Sabre's been in existence since 1971, and the use of analytics for sports was started by a guy named Bill James, a member of Sabre, and that started in the early 80s when he put out his books on he put out an annual that analyzed things and asked the questions, you know, that are the global questions rather than the specific questions where you have one team versus another. In baseball, they would be things such as, well, do we bring our closer in when the best pitchers come up, or do we wait to the ninth inning, and what difference does
right make? right
these
That's
are not
what
questions
started.
Yeah. These are not questions that are related to one team placing playing the other, and you say, well, this team has what they call a hurry up offense. In other words, it does a no huddle offense. How effective, you know, they're looking at the specific. I'm looking for general information, which is out there right now. In baseball, we've got not only Sabre involved, but we got another group called Baseball Perspective, and we have the Baseball Think Factory. But what's interesting about it is that it evolved not from companies doing it, but from individuals on a volunteer basis deciding to do that. And what's happened, as far as I can tell, for football, we've got this champion. We've got a company that was founded by an individual from Northwestern. Notice I never stop mentioning Northwestern. It's like every 5 minutes I got to put them in there. I got to plug Northwestern. So about 5 years ago, a company called Championship Analytics decided that they would get involved in looking at games strategy by way of statistics. And they now have about 50 clients, including
Northwestern.
So
You got to say it again.
Again, it's still in its infancy in terms of looking at, you know, the global questions that I ask. So I never got my question answered about substitution, even though last year I heard it was a Big Ten team on in Texas, which I assume was the Texas Aggies at the time, talking about the importance. And you see what's important about this is not only that the team, you know, obviously you have to have the players. Without the players, you can't do a lot of a substitution.
Right.
If you don't have that second line, forget it. But if you start employing it, you can use that as a recruiting tool whereby you say, you know, we have a lineman right now that's in your position, but wait a minute. He's going to be playing with you, not with you behind him.
Big difference.
That big difference. So you can. So I was just kind of interested. And the fact is that since our situation in baseball evolved through Society for American Baseball Research, I did take a look at the Pro Football Research Association, which was founded in the late 80s, and again found that it's was more looking at history, just as Society for American Baseball Research was. So it's not going to be the vehicle by which it, you know, starts like it did in Sabre. At least it hasn't yet.
Not yet.
And there's another one in college. There's another separate. And again, I think, you, as you pointed out, Jerry, what makes this a little challenging is that football is a game in which there's been a lot of rule changes.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's hard.
That screws up all the statistics.
It does. It consistency is not there like it is with football. So I just thought it'd be a nice thing to kind of start by saying, look, we decided to take a look at statistics. We found out we could only go so far. And it looks like it's starting to evolve, but only time will tell as to whether it will or not.
Let me ask you a question here. Do you think that this thing will really accelerate when some people break off and do it as volunteers? Because what happened in baseball was a lot like what happened in software development. There's a big open source movement where people would write code and they just release it to the public, and it would evolve that way. And somebody would fork the code and add something to it and all kinds of cool stuff, and a lot of great stuff got created, including a major operating system, Linux, that's used on all servers. So you thinking the same thing might happen, that football might follow example and some football enthusiasts might break off if they're not too busy playing fantasy football?
Well, you see, you just mentioned something, fantasy football. And the fact is that what can happen can be that the people that what's made this popular in baseball, again, goes down to money, because Baseball Prospectus and the Think Factory have their publications they put out. They do a variety of things in which there is a company called Baseball Prospectus that does this. So what's going to happen is that I think that the fantasy players are going to have to maybe get a little bit involved in wanting some of the information. The general information that they can then translate to individual players. We know fantasy is not a team sport. It's an individual thing. We have to pick your individual players and look at their statistics. So but quite often what's happening here is that those individual, it's amazing the level of detail.
Fanaticism.
That comes up with, for example, there was somebody, you know, because sometimes you're making your picks with your substitutions in any sport, whether it be football or baseball, at the last minute. So I was listening to something on baseball where somebody said, well, you know what, pick this guy tonight because he's now batting in the beginning of the lineup rather than the end of the lineup. And the point being that, well, yeah, you know what, when you get better hitters, when you're surrounded by better hitters, you're going to be a better hitter yourself because you're going to get better hitters. You're going to get better pitches to hit. So that kind of analysis is what's going to have to happen, I think, in football. And I do believe that it's going to start with the individual movement. And although it's nice to see this company called Championship Analytics Inc., and I thought that you brought up a good point when they tout themselves as putting out a 3-ring binder. It tells a story, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. They're ripe for automation and technology. They're ripe. That should be an iPad app or a Surface app.
Right.
Right, right.
It's like you shouldn't have to thumb through a doggone three-ring binder to get the idea of what you're going to do for your next series of downs.
Yeah, that and the fact that AI is becoming pervasive, artificial intelligence is becoming pervasive on all the platforms right now. So that is ripe. I mean, that's really ripe for the picking. Some app developer is going to get out there and do that for these guys, and that make a huge difference to a coach, I think.
But we have to be careful how we use some of this new technology because, you know, baseball, oops, somebody got to slap their hand. They were using Apple Watches to relay signals.
Yes, they did. They had a little code, didn't they? Oh, Apple Watches are extremely sneaky because the thing you can do with an Apple Watch is you don't have to look at the watch. The watch can tap you on the wrist to indicate a turn, for instance, when you're walking. But it can also tap you on the wrist to indicate what signals it's got called. So the
key to football is that it's okay for you to let your quarterback know what's going on through technology, what's in his helmet. But it's not fair for the opposing team to intercept those signals.
Correct. Correct. Well.
Oh boy.
Yeah. It's getting neat. It's getting interesting, man. This is you and I both love statistics and data, and this is a great time to be alive because we're going to see so much of this stuff happen in so many areas, and see it happen in sports is, I think, really exciting. And I can't wait to see what happens with football. But it's going to be much more challenging though than baseball because of the rule changes and all that stuff. Because there's no consistency. It's going to be much more, and things have to happen fast. Even though I have to say, having been to several baseball games with you up there, in a way, football moves a lot slower. But in a way, it moves a lot faster. So when the action is impending, you have to do things quick. But there's a lot of time between plays, and really, there's not that much time that the players are actually playing, is there, in football? I mean, compared to baseball,
it's amazing. As much as people talk about the snail's pace in terms of the game itself, the amount of action, when you take a look at the percentage of time that, you know, the ball is in play in football, or that there's actually plays taking place in baseball, football is a lower percentage in terms of the total time. Now, the problem is that since football, you know, baseball is not on the clock, you run the risk that you're going to have longer games. And so since they're not on the clock, they don't have as much control over the total time. And that's what's been the problem with baseball. It isn't that there isn't action. The problem is that the amount of total time has been increasing steadily for a variety of reasons. That's a whole other topic. But you're right.
Yeah. Mostly commercially oriented.
It is a myth or a misnomer to look at that and say that baseball, doesn't have as much action, because that's not where the problem lies.
No, it's not. Agreed.
I'm looking at, see, what's nice about the first week of football when it comes to looking for upsets is you asked me this question a while back, says, well, college football actually play exhibition games or, you know, practice games.
Yeah.
And the fact is they don't, but many of the teams, what they'll do is they'll pick what I call a cupcake team. In other words, they'll pick a very inferior opponent to play their first game with. And they'll, of course, play that at home to show their home fans how dominating they are as they beat up on this helpless, you know, other team. and that's where quite often these upsets take place. Back almost 10 years ago, Michigan decided they were going to play a team called Appalachia State. Well, they were into a rude awakening when...
Wow, that's...
have no idea what that is.
Jeez. Oh, man. Well, just think Appalachia. What do you think? You think, you know, coal mines going out of business and all kinds of terrible stuff. Right?
Yeah, you figure, I hope they can find their helmet underneath in the mine or something, you know.
Yeah, but it didn't happen that way, did it?
No, it didn't. And Michigan lost that game. It's considered one of the classic upsets. And so, so we'll just continue looking. Every week I'll kind of keep my eyes open and see if what's going on in regards to upsets. And the other thing just to point out is that college football is so much greater than college baseball. that now you've got also the fact that complicates the matter in football is you got pro football and college football, because college football is extremely popular.
Yes.
So that adds another element of complexity to the whole exercise. But we'll keep plugging away, and hopefully something will be happening on the stats road here when it comes to football.
This leads us into our movie.
It's amazing. Cool. We were talking about different football movies, and I think Jerry picked an incredible one, to the point that I said, "Hey, it's no contest. You've got the movie. It's yours. I'll run with your movie. I'm not going to come up with as good as yours." And that movie was
The Blind Side. And The Blind Side is it's a great Sandra Bullock vehicle. Yeah, she's the star, virtually.
Yes,
and she does an incredible job of playing a real life character, a woman from the South. She's actually from Mississippi, but she ended up in Nashville, I think. John, is it or
Memphis? They ended up in Memphis,
Tennessee.
Yes,
yeah.
The Tui family, Leanne.
Oh yeah, these are. If you've ever worked in the South or lived in the South, this woman is a pure Southern belle, and she's got all the grit and determination that the fine Southern women down here have, and she kind of runs that family. And so in the movie, what happens is, and spoiler, if you've never seen this movie, turn off the podcast and go see it, because it's worth it. And you'll find it almost anywhere. It's a great, great, great movie, The Blind Side. So the whole movie starts out in a really cool way, I thought, is that they start showing Lawrence Taylor virtually crippling Joe Theismann in that famous play where they had to stop the game, and it made everybody sick the way he got his leg broken virtually by our buddy Lawrence. And it's called The Blind Side because these guys, like Lawrence Taylor, they come out of nowhere and whack the quarterback. Now, there's a job to be done here to protect the quarterback. So that's what this movie is about. It's about more than football, though, much more than football, because The Blind Side is about protecting your quarterback, whether he's your brother, your mother, your adopted child, whatever. And it's heartwarming, to say the least. And, you know, a couple times in that movie, you can work up some tears pretty easily, because that's what the movie is about. It's about this woman, Leanne Tui, who decides almost unilaterally. It's kind of funny. Her husband, you know, is this pretty wealthy businessman, owns all these little restaurants around town. But she has an interior decorating business. But boy, she really kind of leads the charge. And the way many women, and not to pick on our women friends, but many women are so good at taking charge without emasculating their men. And this woman's wouldn't you say, John, she's a peach as it regards that?
I do agree. I mean, and a couple of things that you've mentioned already. One is, notice that we have continuing in our discussion here a common theme, and that is linemen. I mentioned linemen in the early part. Linemen are becoming much more important, and that the position that is emphasized here is not the quarterback, not the running back, but it is the lineman acting as the protection from your blind side as a quarterback. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But Sandra Bullock gets, you know, to show you, I mean, she's got a great role to start out with, but she runs with it very well and ends up getting an Academy Award for this. And the movie itself is nominated for Best Picture. So you can see this is what you call a big, very successful $300 million grossing movie.
Oh.
So this isn't your indie film. You said, oops, I missed it because it never showed in the screen. But it's, you know, 2009. Sandra Bullock and the actual role she plays as Leanne Tui. Is you're absolutely right. It shows a woman at her best under the Southern Belle atmosphere.
Umbrella,
She decides that she is, you know, she's got this mission she's on, and once she gets on it, nothing's going to stop her. So
yeah, it doesn't matter what it is. But this was a cool mission. They're driving home from something, and I can't remember what they're driving home, but it doesn't matter really. It's raining, it's cold, and they're driving, and they see this big kid. And you get a little background on this big kid, Mike. that, you know, he got kind of drafted into this high school. It's a private high school. It's a Christian high school. And they are trying to up their sports program a little bit. And the coaches are making a pitch for the board of directors of the school to loosen things up and get some of these kids who are disadvantaged, but who are great sportsmen, to come on, you know, to campus and get them scholarships and all that good stuff. So Mike is one of the guys. He's this big kid, Michael Orr, who is, you know, he almost didn't get in, but he did at the last minute because his cousin was one of the guys they really wanted. So anyway, he gets in, but they don't know it. And he's really one of these guys who's strong and silent, doesn't say anything. Turns out he doesn't really have a place to live. His mother's a crack addict, and that environment's just totally not good. And sometimes he doesn't even have a place to stay if he was with her. So he ends up roaming around the campus and sneaking into the gym at night and sleeping in the boiler room to stay warm, and then sneaking out again and washing his clothes at a local laundromat. She catches him after he's washed his clothes at the laundromat, walking back to the gym, and she says, "Pull over, that's Mike." Or Mikey, I think they call him, or something. Big Mike, that's it.
Big Mike.
Yeah. And so she pulls over, and they talk him into coming home with them. And she dries his clothes and washes them and what have you, and then starts to unravel the mystery that is Big Mike. And this guy is operating under extreme difficulty because, number one, he's learning disabled in the extreme. He's never really had any kind of education at all. He's a big guy and a great athlete, but he's never going to go anywhere unless he gets his academic stuff together. And he's got really nowhere to sleep and only a couple pieces of clothing, for Christ's sake. So this is a real situation. And she
very
could
dire.
Have gone one way or the other. Yeah, very quite dire. And here's the thing about this is everyone is confronted with this. From afar, it's easy to have a lot of compassion for groups of people. But it's much harder to have it one-on-one and to follow through because it's an upset. This is his way of life is so different than the Tui's way of life. They have a huge house, a beautiful house, and all this stuff. And he's totally a fish out of water in it. But, you know, of course, he loves it and thinks it's great. So over a period of time, these guys just say, "Big Mike, why don't you just stay here?" He says, "Okay, I will, but don't call me Big Mike."
Yes.
Which is cool. And so they just, and it's a little dramatized, and I don't want to go into a huge amount of detail how this is not perfectly the Michael or the real person, but it's dramatized, and some of his stuff is played up and some of it is played down, but it's Big Mike.
Well, I think we need to comment about the fact that this is a real story. I mean, this is not fiction.
Yeah.
It's based on a book that came out by Michael Lewis, who wrote the book Moneyball, which was translated into a very popular movie. And so the fact is that that's one of the intriguing things about it. When you're dealing with a real life story, that piques a lot of people's interest. So
yeah,
that doesn't mean that there hasn't. We'll talk a little bit later about how Hollywood is going to have its own spin on and how it plays out, and it will end up having some things in it that are not true, but that doesn't take away and detract from the overall story itself about this disadvantaged youth who was given an opportunity based upon this woman taking, you know, herself completely out of her element. I mean, she's a Southern belle who goes to lunch every week or so with her lady friends who are. When they find out that she's doing it, they say, "Well, how's your project going?" "Well, this is not a project. This is more than that. This is life. This is not a project. This is my family."
Oh, and remember the part in the movie, real cool one, is they're getting the Christmas pictures taken, you know, and that's a big deal in a lot of households where you get your family together, you get a professional photographer in there, and they do it to the hilt because they do it right in their home. And at the last minute, she says, "No, Michael, you're gonna be in the picture." And they pull him in, and sure enough, their Christmas picture includes this massive football guy, and black guy. And I don't know if we've mentioned he was black. Yeah, he is. And
We didn't that, and you know what? I was very sensitive to that, and I was just thinking, you know what? I'm going to wait as long as I can before I say he's black. And I won.
Well,
Sorry.
you did win. But yeah, it didn't occur to me, because when I see this whole thing, it's incidental to
Yeah,
what
you're
color he
right.
is.
I think the fact we waited as long as we did is an indicator of this is more of
Okay,
this is a family
pats on the
thing.
back, pats on the back.
Okay.
It
You
is
get the
family
pat.
though. You get him too. It's family though. That's what she starts pointing out. Now they're trying to get him to play football, and he has some trouble at first playing football. He's actually a great basketball player too, in the movie and in real life. So, anyways, they're having a little trouble getting him in position, finding a place where he'd be good, and all this stuff. And so, you know, it's really cool. They're at this scrimmage, is they're practicing, and you know, the Bullock character, what's her name? Elaine, is it?
Her name is Leanne.
Leanne. Leanne Tui is there on the sidelines, and this is so cool. So they're trying to get into he's tight end. Is that what they're trying to get him to do, John?
No, well, he'd be a lineman. He'd be like a defensive.
Yeah.
He'd be an offensive lineman who's protecting.
Offensive lineman.
So he'd be a tackle or a guard.
Yeah,
he's probably,
playing right off the center, right?
Yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, he's off the center. He's right off
All
the
right.
center.
So, you know, they're trying to get it to show him how to protect the quarterback and stuff like that, and he's just not quite getting it, and he doesn't have the fire. And so the coach is getting frustrated and not doing a good job, and so Leanne just, like, takes charge. She says, I got this. Let me take care of this. She runs over to Michael and, like, grabs him by the jersey, right, the front of the jersey, like coaches do, right? Gets in
Yes.
his face and, like, explains it to him, you know, in terms – this is what the movie's about. In terms that relate to this thing I said earlier, they have a little boy, and Michael's best friends with this little boy, and his thing is to protect the little boy because he's so much bigger than him. And they had an accident where, you know, this car crash, and he put his arm in front of the little boy so that he wouldn't get hurt. And it was kind of remarkable how quickly he did it. He has fast reflexes. So she said to him, "What's your job with and I can't remember the son's name, damn it. But anyway, what's your
Yeah.
with yeah, so what's your job with him? Oh, I protect him. That's exactly what I want you to do with that quarterback. Protect him. He's family. You got to protect him." So she just brought it right down to this new reality he's experienced, which is called a family. And he really gets it, and then he takes off his career, his high school career takes off, and also I think because of that and several other things, his high school career takes off, because not long after he's there, they decide, well, you know, you're college material in terms of sports, but you're
right.
not college material in terms of academics. So they get him a tutor.
And that brings the tutor in, played by
Kathy
Bates.
And the one and only. And she does an incredible job. It's remarkable how well she does. And she's got all these teaching techniques and stuff. Now, the two characters, I believe, who are most true to life is Elaine Tui and this tutor woman. They seem to be very accurate as to how they relate to the real-life characters. They were instrumental, and they are more or less playing pretty true to character. So that was cool. And I love the way that she went through everything and got him to start getting a little hunger for academics. They had to perform several miracles within high school to give him chances to up
right.
his GPA, because it was super low. And somehow they did it. And then they get to the point of the movie where now he's actually getting courted by all these
yes.
Big schools. And that brings us into kind of the stuff we're talking about here, too. So, John, why don't you kind of take it away?
Well,
there?
The thing is that in terms of him, you know, they not only had to get him football ready, but they had to get him academically ready.
Right.
So that's where Kathy Bates plays into it. And what's in the movie is the fact that, and she's, in real life, it's in, the tutor is the engine that basically gets him moving. But the problem is that he's already experienced most of his academic career in high school at a very dismal, you know,
level
effort. Yeah, level. So, you know, he's far below. He's at an F level, and they've got to now play catch up and get him up to a C level so that he can be courted by these various colleges. And they're in Memphis, so You know, one of them is Tennessee, and of course, we've got Leanne's alumni alum. She's an alum from Mississippi. So
all right.
There's a couple different schools, big schools, courting them, and the push, of course, from the family is to stay.
Ole Miss.
Is Ole Miss. So that's where he ends up going. It's as it's explained in the it's in the movie and it's real life that it was a little bumpy road because the amount of influence of family pushed on the situation, in addition to the fact that the football coach for the high school ended up eventually working for Mississippi.
Yep.
Ole Miss. There is a question of maybe whether there were any recruiting violations going on.
Undue influence.
Undue influence. And they eventually landed on their feet. They were able to get them into Ole Miss, and there weren't any recruiting violations in terms of Ole Miss and minor things with respect to the high school football coach. So that all worked out. And he had an incredible career there. I mean, at Ole Miss.
Yeah, but one thing before we get off Ole Miss in the recruiting process, in the movie, and I don't know how true to life this is, they probably dramatized it a bit, but the thing that really made this work, and it relates back to our theme again, you know, family, is that finally he kind of got pushed around by this woman who was kind of interrogating him, trying to find fault with the process and trying to find a violation. Is she kept trying to paint this picture of the Tuies like they were demons, like they were trying to get him to do something that he may not have wanted to do, etc. And so he really had to scratch his head about this, and he walked out of the interview a couple times. And then finally, you know, he went through a whole process in the movie, and he finally came back to the woman and just said to her, look, everyone in my family plays for Ole Miss. I'm going to play for Ole Miss. And she says, what do you mean, everyone in your family? He says, the Tuies are my family. And he was legally adopted, as I recall. Is that right, John?
He was, yes.
Okay. So, boom. You know, that kind of settled it. And whether it's dramatized or not, I like it. Because, again, you know, they got him to learn his position by, you know, tying it into family. So this was a big thing for him, family, you know, all along the way. And that's what kind of helps him see the light and simplify and clarify things so that he can operate. You can imagine how complex and how confusing this can be for a guy who comes out of a completely different environment and goes into this new environment, which is, you know, got different rules, different etiquettes, different everything, you know, and he's got to learn and adapt and all that stuff. Did a great job, as John just said. He had a great career at Ole Miss. How do you do, John?
Well, I mean, to the point that in terms of his success there, he ended up becoming a first round draft pick. And I think the movie comes out in 2009. That's when it's made. And that's about the same time that we're in Michael's life, where he does have this opportunity to move on and take his ability, which is at this point, obviously very, very good, and become a first round draft pick ranked in 23rd overall with the Baltimore Ravens. So I think that's where the movie basically ends on this high note, where, you know, he's been able to go all the way from the point where he's been walking on a road with no place to stay to the point now he's in the spotlight as a result of being drafted in the first round with the, like I said, with the Baltimore Ravens. And you would think, well, gee, that's a great story, but it's amazing how quite often there's even a bigger story in real life. And that story is incredible, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But I think first, it's important to kind of, I like to always look at the differences between real life and what actually happened in the movie, and they're subtle. It's all for dramatic effect. And I think the biggest scene that has been taken in the movie is the one where Sandra Bullock, you pointed out, goes on the football field and does this thing with the family, which is incredibly effective. And that scene is very significant. It's an integral part of this movie. But the bottom line is that this Michael Orr was a good football player before the Tuies met him. He could play football. He was actually the thing. If there's one thing that we kind of, Jerry and I talked about with the movie that is a little distracting, is the fact that the fellow who plays him, and he's not a very well-known actor, by the Quentin Aaron is the fellow. He'd only had two or three or four TV roles, little roles in other things. This is his big break. He's a lumpy looking guy. He's big, but he doesn't look like he's in very good shape.
Right. He's small shoulders, not well muscled, all that.
Well, if you take a look at the real Michael Orr, you're going to find a guy who is 6'4",
chiseled.
Really good size. He's chiseled, and he knows what he's doing on the football field. He is quiet. There's no doubt about that. The real Michael is quiet, just like the movie Michael is. But when it comes to football ability, he definitely has the aptitude in order and the skill set to be a very good football player. So that to me was a big bit distracting.
One.
Yeah. The other thing is, what happens to Michael after he gets drafted? And and again, it's one of those deals where the story is even greater than the movie in some ways. Although the movie has its theme and more in family. Well, now what we're doing is we're talking about Michael Orr, the football player in real life. And what happens is he plays for the Ravens, ends up becoming a star. He's an all-star lineman. And he ends up playing in the 2013 Super Bowl, in which they do win. The Baltimore Ravens end up winning that game. So he's taken it all the way to that extent. And you say, well, that would be a terrific ending to the movie. But, you know, you can't hold it up. The movie comes out in 2009. This whole thing takes place after the flick, you know. And
sure.
So you think, well, that's the end of it. Well, not quite. Michael runs into some challenges with injuries. In 2014 is signed by the Tennessee Titans and has an atrocious, awful year. I mean, I read where he was ranked with offensive linemen 74 out of 78.
Wow.
So
what happened?
What happens is Carolina Panthers end up picking up in 2015. And there's another football player, a well-known guy out of college named Cam Newton. I can't remember what college is. I think it was one of the southern schools, Mississippi, mm-hmm. Alabama. You know, I don't have the right school, but that was his background. And Cam asked for Michael to be part of the team. Says, and not only do I want him, I need him. So sure enough, there's a big comeback in terms of his ability to play, and Michael ends up playing for the Tennessee Titans in 2015 and 2016. And sure enough, after the 2015 season, he ends up going to the Super Bowl again. This is real, though, and they do not win it. They lose to the Broncos, but it's just an amazing story where this guy is, in one year, is considered to be one of the lower linemen, and all of a sudden becomes, you know, comes back and becomes one of the better linemen. And Cam Newton, to show you what happens, and this is another exercise in reality, and this segues a little bit into our third segment, is the fact that in 2016, in the third week of the season, Michael is basically has to discontinue playing football because he's a victim of concussions and he goes on concussion protocol. Now, I don't think it's merely a coincidence that Cam Newton's performance in 2016 was dramatically less. It's because he didn't have his protection. He didn't have Michael there to help him. And sure enough, by the end of the season, he's out because of shoulder surgery, because he's been beat up so bad. And I mean, I remember seeing some of these games where he just felt, I mean, as much as you might say, you know, Cam Newton is, you know, this guy or that guy, you kind of felt sorry for him just the way he was getting beat up. So you think, well, you know, concussion protocol, 2016. Well, he's got the whole time between football seasons to recover from that. Does he recover?
Nope.
No. Starting in 2017, the season we are currently just starting, Michael does not pass his physical because he still has concussion symptoms and he's on concussion protocol. So here we got a player that And the other thing we got to remember is that
31 years old. He's only 31
years old. So this isn't any spring chicken, and football players don't last forever. The shelf life of a doggone running back might be 4 or 5 years. A lineman's right. going to be a little bit longer than that. But it's a cruel business. It is a business.
And yes, it is.
If there's a and there's always another player that's coming out of college that's there to take your job. And so, in effect, one of the coincidences, and it's just amazing how quite often you see things happening. Well, the Carolina Panthers realize that they've got damaged goods in Michael. And so what do? They trade to get somebody else and guess what they do in order to get a reserve for that?
What?
They end up drafting one of the better linemen that went to Western Michigan. Yeah. It's like, I love these little nuances where there's just these little connecting things.
Yeah.
So here we talked about Western Michigan in our first segment, and all of a sudden it pops up in the second. So, Michael, the cruel business is that he's let go. Right. And right now, he's unemployed as a football player. And he is still suffering from concussion symptoms. And it just shows the not only the business, but the physical, the cruel aspect business-wise and also physical-wise in terms of football. And it's something that is a hot topic right now. And it's been a hot topic for 3 or 4 years. And that is, what are we going to do about these concussions? Because we know, and Jerry, you've done a little work on, as we go into our last segment, what's happened, because this isn't something, well, I got a headache and I can rest and I'll be okay. It doesn't quite work that way, does it?
No, let's talk about concussions. And this is the big news, as everyone knows, over the last few years, there's been a lot of talk about CTE, which is, you know, what happened. It's not exactly a concussion. It could be something else. It's a damage to the brain from blows to the head. And that includes concussions, of course. But this is an area that's odd. I'll tell you why. For a couple of different reasons. One reason is that although the explanation for how you get a concussion is fairly simple, and the definition is that your brain is swimming around in fluid, spinal fluid, and it's insulated from damage by this fluid. It's like it's hydraulically packed. And so what happens is you've got a very hard skull to protect it. But if you get a severe blow to the head, your brain is going to hit your skull. The fluid is not going to be viscous enough or high pressure enough to keep it from getting damaged. So there's a lot you can do and not do about all this. And of course, football helmets came into being as a way of preventing this. And oddly enough, there's been a lot of research done on it. There doesn't seem to be a football helmet that can really have much effect on this at all. In fact, there's even a school of thought that the old leather helmets might have been better. So that would be weird.
That school of thought is right now. There's one person in that school. That's me.
I know.
My famous
brother, John. The leader of that school.
Leader of that school. I'm going to say, though,
hey, buddy, that's got legs, though. Because, I mean, you know, why? Because rugby players, that is a really brutal sport. And rugby players do not get any of this CTE stuff. And, and CTE stands for something that's very hard to pronounce. Having to do with the brain.
Yeah, if you can't pronounce it, I'm not even going to get close to it.
Yeah, so, I'm gonna leave that one alone. It's not for concussion, by the way. It's for it has a word that refers to the brain in anatomy. Anyways, go ahead, John. You're gonna say
you brought up a couple points. Number one is the thing with the football helmet. It's a two-edged sword. The fact is, it is there to protect your head. The problem is that football players use it as a weapon. Now, it's illegal to have what's called helmet to helmet. A contact. In other words, you can't go head hunting and take your helmet and as a defense person and then rush into a halfback,
an opponent, and
hit them, whether it be that. And I think it's even worse with these doggone receivers who are out there catching a ball and they're just out there on the clothesline drying.
Vulnerable.
They're just so vulnerable. So that's not allowed. But the point is that even what football coaches instruct you to do from the very beginning is hit the football, the runner, in the numbers with your helmet.
Right.
Well, that's a jarring thing. And whether, you know, we're not hitting your head, but it still has some of the punishment as if you were. So as a result, it can, you know, of repeated doing that activity can lead to it. The other thing about rugby is I decided to take a look at rugby, and they do have, they can wear a, some of the players can wear some sort of leather device on their head if they want to, but most players don't.
Right.
But here's the difference with rugby. Rugby rules will only allow you to arm tackle.
Ooh.
You cannot, you can't do this thing where you know, hit you with your head or this and that. So you have to, the only way you can bring a guy down in rugby, not only way, but the main way you bring him down is just to wrap your arms around him and that's it. So rugby is a vicious sport. And I looked up, and believe me, there is, if I told you there is no incidence of concussions in rugby, I'd be lying to you. It happens, and it's an area that is being looked at very carefully. But to show you where it stands is quite often there is not even a doctor that even the major rugby games. Now, rugby is a very popular sport in New Zealand, Australia, England, et cetera. It's not as big here in the States. But they don't have doctors there that are concentrating on you know, well, let's see if this guy got, you know, cold cocked to the point that doesn't know his first name or last name. There's
right.
not guy, they don't have that in rugby because it just hasn't happened. So I thought the rules are also play a bit, but I'll tell you what, it wouldn't disappoint me at all if the good old leather football helmets came back. Because I just live the old movies with Jim Thorpe. It's kind of a quirky thing where you kind of wish something, you know, will never happen.
Nostalgia.
But, the thing to carry it on with respect to this, as you've talked about, that the disease that is loosely connected to concussion, it's devastating, and it creates, it doesn't happen right away, and there's been enough professional football players that have gotten to the point where it's worse than Alzheimer's, because you become erratic, your behavior is bizarre, and it causes you to actually, you know, to some extent what's going on. And we've had several players commit suicide because they realize the effect. And what's even more dramatic about the way they've committed suicide is they haven't shot themselves in the head. They've shot themselves in their heart because they want to leave their brains for to look at in terms of it, because it can't be diagnosed or known that you've actually got it until it's an autopsy.
Yep. Oh, that's rough. I mean, people don't realize it's pretty easy to shoot yourself in the head because you die almost instantly. And, you know, everything's easier about it. But to shoot yourself in the heart, that's tough because you're not going to die quick necessarily. And it's just mechanically more different and everything. It's not to get too academic about something that's horrible, but that's what it is. And these couple guys have done, Dave Duerson, I think, is probably the most famous.
Yes.
And, of course, he's part of, his story blends into that movie about CTE, how it was discovered, and the doctor who fought the battle against the NFL and all that stuff, which is another day, another topic. But bear in mind, there's now, the reason John and I got into this subject was we noticed that, hey, there's CTE. And among a lot of schools, they're going, I don't want my kid to play football. And some of these schools had lost their football programs because they couldn't field a team. And we thought, well, wow, is this a big thing? Is this going to carry on? Are we going to end up to the point where something happens to the game of football? And guess what? No,
it's amazing. First thing is that you know, me being the stat guy, I decided to do a little work, and it's well documented. It's obvious that there's an association out there of state high school football association, and within that there's they keep track of how many participants we have playing football. And keep in mind that because you need so many players to play, and it is so popular nationwide at the high school level, there are over 1 million participants in high school football in the most recent year, full year. That's 1,086,000. So you read quite often in the news, well, there's been a decrease in the number of participants. And, well, yes, there's been a decrease. There's 25,901 players, you know, players are dropping the number of participants. Now, that you can look at it in terms of schools, and I didn't get any numbers on that, but obviously the number of schools that are not having football has decreased to some extent. But I decided to take a look at the participants specifically, because those are numbers I have. And I said, well, now what's happening is we have had the decrease in the number of participants at 2.4%. So what that means is that if it continues at that level, in 5 years, we'll still have 962,000 football players out there in high school. So there's going to be still a lot out there. The other thing that's happening is that there are other things that are causing a decrease in high school football. High school football is expensive.
Yep.
It's a very expensive with the equipment, et cetera. In addition to the fact that you need more people, you need more participants on a team than any other sport. Take a look at it. Basketball is the obvious lowest when you only have five on the court, and you've got maybe 12 or 13, you know, on your team. Well, when you're talking football, you're talking 50 you know, kids are there on the team. Big. So, you know, and the other thing is we've got this hotbed of football where it is going to continue to be. So I actually, in spite of this, football had a decrease, but actually an additional 61 schools decided to make football a part of their program in 2016 and 17.
Right.
So, you know, this is an area where you might think, well, when's the death of football? What's going to be the last game we're going to see? No.
Well, that's fake news.
Right. Without a doubt.
That is truly fake news, because that is some, I hate to say it, but some kind of liberal kind of author or, you know, writer, reporter, kind of slanting a story, because those aren't the real numbers, and that's not really what's happening. And maybe they would like their kid not to play football, and that's why they're writing this thing. But the truth is that it is increasing. John, what's the percentage of decrease? You had the number.
2.4%.
Wow. Not much.
But here's, and the other thing that we got to keep in mind is football in some states is just crazy. And I hate to point out, but your state happens to be probably one of the biggest.
And it is. I think it is the biggest. High school football in Texas is unlike high school football in any other state. It is a religion. They'll drop reading or arithmetic, or they'll drop football.
I mean, truly. Friday night is it. That is the social, that doesn't have to be put on your social calendar, because that is a given.
And it's not about money.
There's actually a TV show, Friday Night Lights or something, that came out.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's been publicized how important it is, you know, in terms of that. And to show you how, even though it isn't big money, There is some money involved, and I was able to find out that within the last year, actually at the beginning of this year, the most expensive football stadium ever opened in Texas, $70 million. That's how much it was to make, and that's for one team. Now, Jerry mentioned that in Austin, they've got a stadium that's used by several. It's a big stadium, but at least they're smart enough to allocate the cost between a variety of teams, so they have more than one team plays that. Yeah, they share it to some extent.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. They don't have to, because every school has its own football stadium too. But what this is a super big one, so that when you have conference or championship kind of games,
everybody can go.
Yeah, you can get them in there, and they have one for basketball. They have a stadium for basketball. And they have one for football, but you know they multi use these facilities. Also, I should say that during Katrina, we housed like people from New Orleans for at least 2 months in the Burger Center, which is what we're talking about here, in the auditorium, and to an extent in the football field too. And so it's used for other things. other events occur there. They have a powwow there for the Indian nations around our area every year, which is great. And they have that in the auditorium. So, you know, Austin's got a conscience, and they're really sensitive about a bunch of stuff, but they're still crazy about their football like everybody else.
Well, at least they're using it for other things and getting some, you know, use out of it.
Yeah.
It's
not monothematic. Like, once you get out in the West Texas and stuff like that, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
That's it.
Wow.
I know.
Boy, it's amazing.
Yeah, it is. The people are amazing. Our country is amazing. Our states are amazing. And, I wish I could spend my remaining years just traveling around, getting to know all these areas, because it's truly fascinating. It's something I could study forever. But anyways, we're running out of time.
Yeah, so I'm amazed. This is the last topic I thought we'd ever talk about football. I'm a baseball guy. But yep. It just has certain things that kind of I thought were interesting that they're timely,
yep.
They're great stories. And
yep.
Again, we could finish up with a little fake news there. So that's always good to be
yeah,
able to
we
report.
Yeah, we've got our fake news in there. And okay, John, I thought I'd take this opportunity to do two things. Number one, tell everybody where to get their T-shirts, of course.
And oh, that's right.
I
still got mine on.
Me too. I didn't take it off during the show, which is really took some willpower. So, yeah, we sound like loonies, but that's great.
Oh.
What the hell? What do we got to lose? So anyways, here's the deal. You go to thebro.show, type that into your web browser, and that'll take you to where all these wonderful podcasts are, and you'll see plenty of links on there to get a shirt. But if you don't want to bother with the podcasts and you just want to go straight to get a T-shirt, I can't blame you. It's difficult not to. shirt.thebro.show will take you right to the T-shirt, and you get the Clark
Ooh.
Street Ale House T-shirt, which is pretty famous by now. And
yeah.
So it's beautiful too. I'm wearing it, and I can't say enough about it. Comes in three colors: blue, gunmetal gray, or black. And John and I are rocking the gunmetal gray. We both decided we wanted to get that one.
Yeah. Well, the other two shirts were blue and black, so we thought, you know.
Yeah,
I just get a little variety here.
Yeah. We independently decided to get those colors, oddly enough.
Yeah.
Weird.
All good.
Brothers. So anyway, we got that, and I want to mention something like that. So go get your T-shirts. There are expenses associated with podcasts and you know, buying microphones, and we have to upgrade our technology and stuff like that. So that this really helps out. Plus, I do use it for my cancer fund. A lot of stuff doesn't get covered by Medicare. So,
trips are expensive too.
Ooh,
when you come up to Chicago,
wow!
Come on, then we've got to go on. On site to out on location here. Yeah,
people don't realize that we scout location. Wow!
Yes,
talk about expensive. We had to buy chicken and all kinds of stuff and eat and break bread. Well, anyway, I'm making fun of it, but do get a T-shirt, and about half of that money goes to our fund, which is great. And you can also make donations there too if you want to, which I encourage you to do. So anyway, that's that. Now my second piece is, all right, we did have some big news this week, and it seemed fake, but it wasn't. The big news this week was Donald Trump teamed up with the Republicans to actually get something done. And I'm sure that shocked a lot of people, but he did this trifecta where, you know, they had to deal with the debt ceiling, fund a hurricane, and do the budget and all this stuff. And boom, it just got done. And he sided with the Democrats on all these issues in order for it to get done, because he got tired of waiting for the Republicans to get their act together, because they never will get their act together. They're divided. They're house divided. They've got these super conservatives who won't do anything. And then they got these kind of somewhat conservatives. And then they got like almost Democrat kind of people. So they don't have enough to yield a majority, a 51 member majority on a lot of these issues. So Trump very wisely just said, Chuck, Nancy, come on down. And he got him in the Oval Office along with Mitch McConnell and this Ryan character. And
right. Michael Ryan.
I heard a podcast where a guy says, They got Ryan and McConnell and pantsed them in the Oval Office. That's about right, isn't it? Pantsed them.
Hey,
boy,
you
did.
Know what? Speaking of slick moves, I actually thought the Dreamer movie made was incredible.
Yes.
The one with the kids, because what it was brilliant. Because what he basically says is, "Look, guys, we're gonna stop this because it was an executive order, and if you think it's that
it's
damn
illegal.
Important,
yeah, it's illegal."
Yeah. So he says, "Look, because think about this: if it goes the executive order route, it's going to go flip flopping back and forth depending upon who's president, and everybody's going to, you know, it won't work."
Right.
So he says, "Look, what we're going to do, guys, is we're going to put your feet to the fire up there at the on the Congress
on the hill,
and if you really want it on the hill, I'm going to give you 6 months and make something happen. It's in your court."
Yeah,
I thought that
move.
Was good.
Yeah, I thought it was good too. A lot of people disagree with it, but I thought it was a good move.
Well, you know, the fact is, you can disagree with the whole concept, but what he's done is he's basically brought it to a head and said, "Look, we've got to stop pussyfooting around. I have my opinion, but if you think your opinion is going to fly, go make it happen."
And guess what? They're facing the same thing with DACA that they just faced with the budget and the debt ceiling and all that stuff. And also, by the way, Trump put forward in that meeting, "Let's just get rid of the debt ceiling," which should be done. It's a purely stupid thing. It's only used for politics. It doesn't matter. All the debt ceiling says is we're going to pay the bills we've already accrued, which is kind of stupid. So if they should get rid of it, because it's only used for politics by either side. So Trump came around and said it. Now, guess what? With DACA, come 4 months, if nothing's been done, I guarantee you he'll go in there and say, "Hey, Chuck, hey, Nancy, come on down."
Could be.
Yeah, and I'm going to stick my neck out here a little bit. I said this. I don't know if I said it on a podcast, but I definitely said it to you, I think, John. I believe in the end, the resolution to the healthcare thing is going to be single payer, and I bet you Trump leads the charge. Because that's how he'll stay in office.
You have talked about single payer on the podcast. I don't think you've actually put Trump at the on the front end of that. So that is a little bit different.
Well, yeah, I've felt for some time now that he's going to have to do that. And the reason I thought so was because that's the only way he could stay in office, not get impeached or anything else like that, and kind of rescue his tattered beginning, because that would totally rescue it. I mean, he would be a hero if he did that. And now I see how he could do it. It's not crazy, because look what he just did.
Yeah.
He could. It would take a little nuance, and he would have to get his strokes down in order to figure out how to do it. But it could be. I think it could be done, and it won't happen immediately, and doesn't need to. But they're already shoring up Obamacare, so there's no. And also the Dreamers, he did a tweet, Nancy Pelosi, another cool thing. The morning after their meeting, Nancy Pelosi goes, "Wow, you know, she's out in California, and everybody there's freaking out about DACA because there's so many immigrants." She says, "Mr. President, it would really help if you tweeted out that these kids don't need to worry; they're going to be okay for 6 months. No action is going to be taken against them." He said, "No problem," and he tweets it right out.
Sweet.
So,
good.
Hey, starting to sound like a functional government.
Oh yeah, gee, we could talk about this for a long time, and we probably will on another podcast.
Yes, we will.
Okay. It's important, no doubt. But I'm glad you brought that up. Squeeze a little bit of extra stuff in.
Yeah,
all good.
All right, you guys have my prediction, and you have the URL, the web link to the t-shirts. Go get them. And John,
okay.
I will be talking to you on the rebound.
Sounds good. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.